Welcome to episode 83 of the Rugby League Republic podcast with your host Tish and Dr. T. In this episode, we debate whether the Storm are title contenders, whether the NRL should persist with fixture cramming, and our views on the NRL Hall of Fame ballot, as well as our tips for round 9 of the NRL. Join us as we build a rugby league community for all. The Rugby League Republic podcast starts right now. Welcome to episode 83 of the Rugby League Republic podcast, where we aim to build an online rugby league community for everybody. Each week, we bring you the everyday fans' perspective on the biggest news and issues in the world of rugby league, and we break it all down for you in our own unique way. I'm your co-host, Dr. T. Joining me is Tish. Tiger Tish, unfortunately, you're not as happy as you have been in the past, but how was your week?
Oh, look, a real downer, I've got to say, going down to the Eels, not taking anything away from the Eels, great game, great sort of close thing, but, the Tigers, were singing high praises of them early in the year. They went out, they destroyed a couple of premiership contenders, and now they're languishing on a losing streak. They're almost as bad as Manly at the moment. So, a bit disappointed, but look, also very excited about the quality of rugby league. And you know what? I watched a great movie over the weekend. The Infinity War. And I'm just interested. Who is the Thanos of the 2018 NRL? Is it the Melbourne Storm? But anyway, we can go into that a little later. But look, really excited about rugby league and really excited about what we're going to be talking about on this show.
That's a super question. In fact, we should have had that as one of our... It's good enough to be a tackle, I think. But
wow.
I'll just chip in on that. I haven't seen the movie yet, but I'm going to go for Gus Gould as the Thanos of the NRL. Yeah. Does he not sort of look like someone that he's hungry for some rings, isn't he? Like, he's hungry for some stones. I don't know.
I
don't know. It's a good question. But who's got a chin and a big enough to be Thanos worthy? I mean, who's Nate Miles? Oh, he had a forehead. Sorry, not a chin.
Yeah,
big enough for a Thanos. I don't know. It's a good debate for another time. But look,
well, without spoiling the movie, let me say it to you. There's a question mark that the movie poses on the viewer, which is Thanos doing the right thing or the wrong thing? So
he's a villain with a heart of gold. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying he's got a point of view, and he may not necessarily be wrong.
There you go.
Maybe he is a bit of a Phil Gould if you think about it in those terms.
There you go. Well, that's deep, man. We haven't even
tackles. It is. Well, let's just end the Marvel War talk there. So.
Let's do it. Maybe we'll do it. Well, when are they doing Marvel round this year? Maybe we'll do a specific Marvel related tackles questions about, the deeper meaning of the Marvel universe and its link to the NRL universe. I mean, this is now that you just, it just got me thinking, Tish, a little bit of a light bulb there just went off. Rupert Murdoch, Thanos. was the Super League War, maybe he had a point.
Maybe.
Good question. Anyway.
Yeah. Lots to think about and talk about, I think, tonight. Right.
And look, just right off the bat, I'd like to just apologize for my sort of croaky voice and sort of, I yelled myself hoarse when the Eels' victory over the Tigers. But I've got to say, look, I know you're disappointed, Tish, but to all Tigers, yourself included, all Tigers fans out there, an open-hearted comment from an Eels fan. We have something in common, Tigers fans. Now you know what it's like to be disappointed by the Eels. we've been there before, let me tell you, Tigers fans. We know what it's like. Six in a row this year, remember. All right. Look, let's get into our... Oh, actually, before we get into our tackles, let's review the results of round eight, which we're going to... before we get into it. So the Dragons, and this is the Anzac round, the all-important Anzac round. It certainly delivered some great games. Like the topsy-turvy NRL is starting to tip over a little bit more, I think, after this round. So let's have a look. The Dragons defeated the Roosters 24-8 on Anzac Day, the Big Sydney Clash, cementing their spot at number one. The Storm flogged the Warriors, who were equal first at that point, 50-10. Wow. Unbelievable. And that's going to lead into our first tackle about the Storm's premiership credentials there. The Rabbitohs and the Broncos. Look, the Broncos, again, both of these teams have been a bit inconsistent this year. The Broncos winning this one 24-20. The Knights and the Seagulls, that local derby up there in the north of Sydney / Hunter region, won by the Knights 18-12. Bit of an upset, considering where the Knights were last year. The Panthers and the Bulldogs, are the Bulldogs still languishing down near the bottom, losing 22-14 against the Panthers. The Sharks in a in an unusual scoring game against the Titans, 10-9.
Wow.
Unbelievable. You'd think it was an Oceania soccer qualifier with that kind of score. Cowboys and Raiders. The Raiders, again, languishing the Cowboys down the bottom this time. 18-8 over the Cowboys there. So a good win there. And, of course, the Eels 24-22 against the Tigers. The 2-point win wasn't enough to overcome the 20-point or so for and against deficit that they had against, I think, the Cowboys, which is the only team above them. They're actually equal last, but on for and against, they're last. So what they really wanted was a flogging. What they needed was a flogging of the Tigers to get up off the bottom, but they're still there. So, they live to fight another day, and at least they're on level pegging with, I think, the Cowboys and the Bulldogs as well.
Yeah,
down the bottom, so that's not so bad for them. But anyway, yeah. It's round nine. Any comments on the Anzac round there, Tish?
Well, the other thing I'd mention is that some of the results were a bit surprising, because I think some of the informed teams, like the Warriors and the Tigers, going down, the teams that needed to prove themselves, and what that has done is I think it's kind of crunched the ladder up a bit. There's teams sort of shuffling around, so makes for a great season. I think this is one of the most hotly contested seasons of all time. So great work NRL, particularly when it comes to player transfers this year. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, look, I don't know if we can credit the NRL with that. The closeness, I think there's a lot of factors that we've talked about it a few times, but yeah, let's see how it shapes up. Certainly at the beginning of this season, it's been quite exciting that the results are quite different to what we would have expected, but makes it all the more interesting, especially getting into the Origin season. It's getting cold in Sydney, which means Origin is just around the corner, and so here we go with our six tackles. And tackle number one. The first great mate debate. Are the Storm title contenders? Tish, what do you think? Are you going to... Let's try and stick to our little kind of, method here.
Yeah.
I'll leave this to you. Are you going to vote yay or nay?
I'll vote yay.
All right, go for it. Prove me wrong, the other Storm title contenders. Go for it.
Well, look, I think the Melbourne Storm, they've had a rocky start to the season, but they've had rocky starts to seasons before. They've had a couple of, crucial changes in their roster, with obviously Cooper Cronk no longer at the club, and, that's kind of the big change, but a few other changes out there, losing a few players as well. And gaining players like Sam Cassiano and a few others, Nelson Salamona, I think it is. But look, I think overall, so they've had a couple of rocky starts of the season, but now they're starting to find a bit of form, And I think that that's actually holding them in good stead. You know, they're the defending champions. They've got players who have been there and done the dance before. They've got players that have played big matches like State of Origin, that have played International Rugby League. So they've got all the experience. They've got the they've got the young, hungry players now in their team as well, looking to make a mark on a good franchise. And I think everything, they've got all the ingredients in place to be a contender. So I think for the fact that they're baking a cake and they're using the right ingredients. On that basis, I think they are contenders, and the fact that they're showing a bit of form now, heading into mid-season, I think shows that they are definitely a contender, and any team that has to play the Storm in the finals will, they'll be frightened, quite frankly, because they know what Melbourne can do, particularly when it comes to pressure situations in big games. And that is why the Storm are not only title contenders, they're a title threat.
Wow. Well, I'm not convinced, Tish, because because of two words, Cooper Cronk.
Ooh, the Cronkster.
The Cronkster. This is the perennial question this year. What happens to the Storm, the premiers, the current holders of the premiership, when you take out Cooper Cronk out of that recipe, as you call it? Well, so far, it's been an eaten mess, because the cake that they were trying to bake is a little undercooked, let me tell you. Without Cooper Cronk, and look, it's hard to say at this stage, quite honestly, because the Storm have the tendency to, fly off initially to be off the blocks very early and quick and well, knowing that during State of Origin, the State of Origin season, they are decimated by representative duties. What's going to happen this time around? They haven't really gone off the blocks that quickly. And if you look at, and they've been quite inconsistent, they've lost twice to the Tigers. They've had sort of several unimpressive games. We're at round 9 already, and they've really only had one, I would think, one really impressive game, which was last weekend's flogging of the Warriors, who were equal first and equally impressive and as title contenders. However, I'm going to argue that is a bit of a false, gives people a false sense of security, that result, because I think the Warriors went back to their bad old habits of years gone by, where, they were starting to make good progress and Stephen Carney was trying to make some good cultural change there. And I think once in a while, when you have this sort of long-term cultural sort of change programs within a culture of a club that's not been in a winning frame of mind, you're going to have setbacks. So I think last week was more about the Warriors having a reality check letting the success get to their heads, rather than the Storm being premiership contenders. And I think what will happen is, when you see them in tight situations, as they have been a few times already this season, they have never been able to, overcome those pressure situations. And why? Because they don't have Cooper Cronk. Cooper Cronk was the glue. He was the calm head on the shoulders of the stars like Smith and Slater, etc. Without him there, they're relying too much on Cam Smith, and he can't really make those crucial calls at halfback. You need a calm half to do the job, and Munster is just too inexperienced. So I think they're going to miss Cooper Cronk when sides are getting close enough to them to threaten. And you've seen that already. The Tigers, in close games against them, ended up running away with it both times and defeating them. And that would never have happened with Cooper Cronk there. So that's my reasoning why they're not title contenders. It's too early to go off half-cocked about them, because Cooper Cronk isn't there, and you'll start to see how much they miss him at the business end of the season. So I'll let you have the final say.
Okay, well, look, you brought up the Cooper Cronk now. Cooper Cronk is playing for the Roosters. The Roosters are actually lower than the Storm on the ladder.
Yep.
So, yes, they've lost Cooper Cronk, but they're still doing better than the team that he's gone to. So, not sure about that. And plus, you know, Cooper Cronk, although I'm actually personally a big fan of him, I think he's a great player. You know, he's been playing the role of Luke Kerry's apprentice or Luke Kerry's secretary for the Roosters because it's Luke Kerry running that team. But that's another little side note there. But look, I think the Storm, look, it might be a bit early and, you know, analysis, you might have actually won me over because I'm just thinking about, they also flogged, I think it was the Rabbitohs or the Bulldogs in round one, and now they've flogged the Warriors. So it seems like, you know, if the Storm get onto a bit of a roll on, they look unbeatable, but then in a tight game, they sort of lose their marbles, and maybe Cronk was the master of the marbles for the Storm, which is might be the reason why. So, yeah, look, you've convinced me. The Storm, maybe a bit early to call them a contender, and certainly way too early to call them a threat. So I concede to your victory, O humble.
Wow. I'm going to... That's two wins in a row. I'm counting the Eels one as a win as well. So there you go. All right, let's move on to tackle number two. And a great mate debate part two. And this one is, should the NRL persist with fixture cramming for New South Wales rivals? So fixture cramming is... Now, we've talked about this a few times. We've never actually heard the term fixture cramming until it was used in the media this week. Apparently, it's a thing, Tish. Fixture cramming is that thing we've been talking about where the NRL has scheduled, you know, some of the local derbies in the New South Wales teams against each other in very short space of time at the beginning of the season, almost like to get those fixtures out of the way. It's annoyed a lot of fans because it's kind of weird to, you know, like for the Eels and the Tigers to have played each other twice within a month. Really, really strange. I mean, as a fan, you kind of want, you know, maybe you want to be able to sort of see, get back at your... at the team that beat you later in the season when you've kind of regrouped and had a bit of time to mature as a team rather than just, you know, off to sleep and then all of a sudden, oh, there you go, back again. So this is all about that. Should they persist with this? There was an article in the Sydney Morning Herald this week that suggested that they will continue to persist with this this kind of method, this way of cramming those fixtures within a short space of time. I guess the debate is, Tish, do we think that's a good idea or not? Should they persist? So
I'll let you have your floor. I'll let you have the floor, and I will no doubt come up with a strong argument against whatever you say.
Well, here we go. Well, I'm going to say no. They should not persist. Okay. I get the feeling you might hold that view genuinely as well. But let's see how we go as a debate. So, look, I think the NRL should not persist with this fixture cramming, partly for the reason that I just suggested. I think it's kind of very strange to have, to have teams play each other twice in such a short space of time. It doesn't really allow the first result to sink in that much before you have to sort of back up again and play the same team again. The danger there is that if you play a team that's on fire, like say, you know, maybe the Storm are on fire at the moment or the Dragons or the Warriors or the Tigers, that you know, within a short space of time, you'll be defeated again. Maybe that's why the Storm were defeated twice. Had they played later in the season, maybe the Tigers would be a bit scared, you know, of the Storm. So this is why I think they should not persist with fixture cramming. I think it's does a disservice to the fans. It makes no sense whatsoever. It would make more sense to spread out these fixtures during the season. And more to the point, early in the season, apart from Easter and the Anzac round, we don't really have we should really take advantage of some of these local kind of derbies in a different way than what the NRL is doing. So by in a way wasting some of these fixtures early in the season, For instance, the Eels and Tigers on. Yes, we know it's an Easter Monday fixture, but by wasting it last weekend when nothing was really doing, you know, as part of an Anzac round where the focus is on other kind of other kind of games, you miss an opportunity to have potentially two of the most well-supported Sydney teams playing each other at the back end of the season as we approach the finals. And I think that's the real danger here, is that some of these fixtures that have been crammed are actually potentially gold money winners and crowd gatherers, so to speak, at the latter part of the season. And so on that basis, I say the NRL should stop doing this and put some common sense into their fixtures.
Okay. All right. Well, look, great arguments there. And, you know, I generally do subscribe to your thoughts. The counter argument that I do have, though, is that, you know, I think I kind of get it a little bit. At the start of the season, you want to cram in some of your rivalries. You want to cram in some of your big games because, you know, it's still open for both teams to make it to the finals. And, you know, there's consequences to those games. I'm going to take the Tigers and Parramatta example. You know, they played each other twice this year, and they also played each other twice last year. Now, these games were only, what, about a month apart, or, you know, three to four weeks apart this year. And it meant that both games, you know, had consequences for both teams. You know, the Tigers won the first one. The Eels were still trying to get their first win in the game. Now the Eels have finally won one, and now in the second game, you know, it's a chance for them to quickly avenge the loss that's still fresh in their mind. As opposed to last year, where they met early in the season, again at Easter time, and there was excitement and buzz around the game. And then later on the season, they met each other again towards the end of the series and towards the end of the regular season. And it was a crucial, important game for the Eels in their march towards the finals. But, you know, there wasn't really that much incentive from the Tigers to actually play that well because they were out of contention anyway by that stage. So it meant that we kind of lost one of the Sydney rivalry games on the basis of the fact that we left it too late. And if at least when you schedule them all early, each of these rivalries will have consequences for both teams as they're trying to build their season. And I think the NRL kind of realised that perhaps the start of the season, people are excited. So the first 2 to 3 weeks, people are going to go out to the games. People are going to be excited about talking about rugby league. Then as you sort of go on, you know, it's not new anymore. So I think that's when they try to kick in some of the rivalry games, the Easter weekend, the long weekends, the double headers to try and keep momentum going all the way until you get to the state of origin. Then that takes the center focus, the NRL not so much, but people are still talking about rugby league because of the state of origin. And then straight after the state of origin, it's the road to the finals. And it doesn't matter who you're playing on the road to the finals, all the games leading up to the finals, no matter who you play, gets exciting because of, you know, whether or not your team can make it and whether or not which teams are going to make up the top eight. So, you know, that's going to be the incentive for people watching and going out to games towards the end of the season. So why don't we cram all the rivalries here at the start of the season to get people excited towards the late start, early middle part of the season. And I think that's why they do the cramming.
Well, I'm not sure I'm convinced of that, Tish. I actually don't know. Like, have they ever expressed why they do it? Because if that's the reason why they do it, I would like to challenge some of those assumptions.
Okay. well, that's what I can think of. But no logical reason why they do it like this. But one I can think of. Yeah.
No, you've done a great job trying to get into the heads of the NRL schedulers. Look, but before you get too stuck in Narnia there. I hope you get out back to reality because NRL scheduling is something, as we've talked about in the past, it is a brave, puzzling new world, I think. So it's very strange. But look, I mean, the Eels and the Tigers is a counterexample, I think, that I think we really need to focus on. These are two, you know, potential, well-supported teams in Sydney it kind of makes no sense to play those games so early in the season when you can just sort of, you know, there's a thing about sort of almost every other kind of major, you know, especially footballing kind of competition in the world of, and football, I mean broadly, different kind of football codes have this thing where, you know, there's some symmetry sometimes to where,
yeah,
to the scheduling, you know, like you play rounds 1 to, I don't know, 18 or 17 if there's an 18 team comp, and then you flip it and you play the same, you know, on round 18 you play the team that you played in round 1, and it basically just repeats itself, so that way it's fair, you know, whoever you know, there's the same distance between the two teams that the two times that you play a team twice during the season. And yes, I think that there's an element of fairness there that as I said, if you're unlucky enough to draw against the Storm when they're on fire, it's 4 points that you're going to lose, you're going to drop because you happen to have a bad time of, you know, like some injuries, and the Storm are on fire, they've got momentum. You know, having that kind of symmetry and spreading of the games makes it fair, so that you kind of think, oh, well, you know, yeah, we had an injury in the first round, well, first time we played them earlier in the season, but later on, you know, that injured player came back and whatever, and people won't feel like it's unfair. So I think the fairness factor is something that the NRL has to consider as one of the reasons why people don't support this kind of fixture cramming. And I think that's ultimately the thing, that regardless of what we think the NRL's reasoning for this is, I think it's an unfair kind of, you know, system for the fans primarily, and for the clubs, especially when you're in that situation where you might lose against a team twice. So I'm going to draw a line under that, and let's move on to tackle number 3. So Phil Gould has said an outrageous statement. That basically he thinks that the 7 tackle rule should be abolished. So Tish, do you have any further insights into why he says this before we start the debate?
Well, I think why he said it is because it probably means that probably the Penrith Panthers don't like it.
Okay. Right. Are you saying he has an agenda?
I think that's pretty clear, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, don't we all?
Yeah. Look. So I think that's basically it. And look, do you have a take on whether you support this move to abolish it or whether you
I say it should be abolished.
Oh, okay, really? Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, let me hear you out, and I'll see if I can rebut this one. Yeah. Okay.
So let me just get this right. So the seven tackle rule, what that means is that when a team kicks, an attacking team kicks the ball, and it goes dead in goal, then it's not just when it goes dead in goal, it's also when it's in the field of play, is that right?
Yeah.
No. And it's retrieved. No, sorry, it's when it goes dead in goal. Then is that the only time that they get 7 tackles? Just remind me if that's the
rule. So if it goes dead in goal, that's one time. The other time I think it's when the opposing team drops the ball, and then you pick it up, and you don't actually you don't need a scrum, so you've picked it up cleanly.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
You also get so it's for cleanly retrieving the ball from a drop ball, you get a free tackle, and then the other one is when the other team kicks the ball dead,
A tap on the 20-meter line, and it's a 7 tackles from there, I think.
Yep. And they introduced that part of it since people were kicking out on the to sort of avoid the fullback from taking a big run in broken play. They thought teams. I think St. George, they pretty much won a premiership out of it, kicking the ball dead rather than actually having the elusive fullback coming you know, just sort of trying to avoid the fullback getting the ball and running into broken play. You kick the ball dead and you know, there's no consequence for that. So I think that's why they introduced the seven tackle when you do that. So
yeah. Look, they're kind of two different situations, but in general, I agree that it's maybe the thing is it should. I don't agree with the seven tackle, like, you know, and basically what that means is it's a zero tackle, they call it, I believe. Yeah. So it's like, you know, it starts at zero tackle. The reason being is that there's a couple of reasons why I think it should be abolished. A, it's confusing to the fans. You know, we know the game very well, and we struggle to kind of find the reasoning why they do it. I get why they decided to change the rule, but the problem is if you, and there's a broader problem here, if you decide to change certain rules in order to kind of shape the game, to shape the game, the behaviors of teams in a particular direction, if that's your goal to make a lot of tweaks in order to, you know, because you don't like teams kicking it out on the, you know, in the dead goal line or that kind of thing, well this is the thing, like, if you do that for everything, then you end up undermining the fundamental rules. And one of the fundamental rules is that there are six tackles in your set. There should be no exceptions to this. Now, I can see the situation where if you're an attacking team and you drop the ball and, you know, the opposing team gets it, runs 10 meters, gets tackled. Now, the argument there is, well, technically their set didn't start properly, so they should have a zero tackle there. I disagree with that. The set starts when you've got the ball. If you got the ball in an awkward position, and, you know, just say you're kind of it's Billy Slater collects the ball from a grubber kick from Ben Hunt, and gets smashed 1 meter from the line, right? Well, why should that be a zero tackle when? You know, like, I get what they say. I get the argument. I understand. I think most people would understand. It seems kind of unfair that one tackle was wasted, and that the attacking team, which is now the Storm, would be at a disadvantage because they're pinned down on a 1 meter line, and it's basically one tackle gone. But that's how it's been for years and years and years, and so. Again, if you start saying, well, now, so in that situation, he gets tackled, right? And it's counted as zero tackle. But what if he breaks the tackle and runs 90 meters and almost scores? Would you count that as a zero tackle? He's taken advantage of the fact he's got the ball and somehow managed to run through the defense and ran almost the length of the field. The fact is, and this is what I'm saying, I think if you've got the ball in hand, it should only really be six tackles. That's your set. Yes, you are at a disadvantage if in that situation, if you get pinned on your own 1 meter line. However, what effect would that have if we go back to six tackle rule instead of the current seven tackle rule or the zero tackle? What would the effect be? Well, maybe you'd see a lot of these grubber kicks close to the line. You know, and so maybe that would be more exciting for the game.
Okay.
So I sort of argue that in that situation, which is the strongest situation where you would want to retain the seven tackle rule, I think, I still think we should go back to six tackles. It makes it easier to understand. Once you get the ball and then you tackle, that's the first tackle. It's unfortunate. But again, you've got five more tackles to do something with the ball. So it's not like you know, NFL where you've only got four downs or whatever. You've got five more tackles. So you can still do something with the ball. In a situation where you kick the ball dead, I think that's a no-brainer. There is no disadvantage for you getting that ball back. It should just be a straight six tackles. Anyway, so that's my sort of ill-informed view on on what I think should happen. But yeah, just basically, I think it shouldn't. They should be abolished primarily for consistency and simplicity for the fans. So, what do you think?
Okay. Well, strong argument. I'm going to take you back all the way to the origins of rugby league. Right. So rugby league is a derivative. I know we don't like to say it, but it is a derivative of rugby union, which was an amateur game played in England. And I mean, played in more than countries in England, but at this time it was played in England. Northern England is where rugby league started. And it broke away to sort of basically, essentially pay players and pay the poor players who were sort of forced to play a little bit, but to sort of pay them and give them compensation for injuries and so forth. So at the very start of the game, because they were paying players, they had to modify the rules to A, make it safer for the players so there's less injuries, and B, to actually make the game more exciting. So that there's more of a paying audience that will come out and watch the game. And if you go through the major changes of the rules that have gone throughout rugby league, they try to accomplish one of these two things. They either try to make the game safer or they try and make the game more exciting. We went from unlimited tackles to 4 tackles to 6 tackles. We changed the try, what you get for a try, and all that sort of thing, just to make it a bit more exciting and streamlined. We changed from a 5-meter rule to a 10-meter rule. We've played around with how many interchanges. We've done unlimited interchanges. You know, we've sort of tweaked the game as much as we can to try and make it more and more exciting. And the 7-tackle concept, in a way, makes the game more exciting because it is sort of, in a way, penalizing the penalty it's penalizing negative play from an attacking team rather than, okay, you know, you don't really have an opportunity to get a repeat set, so you kick the ball dead so that the opposition's, you know, main strike player, cannot get the advantage of running through break and play. So now you have a 7-tackle set, and all of a sudden, you want to avoid the 7-tackle set because within 7 tackles, usually most teams are able to then start putting attacking pressure on you, just because that extra tackle takes them a lot further up the field. So I think in a way it's actually made the game more exciting, and I think it has introduced more grubber plays because the kickers have to be a lot more accurate. They have to be a lot more clever when it comes to kicking near the goal line because they can't kick it dead. If they kick it dead, you know, they're going to get a 7-tackle set, so there's a bit more pressure to get the right kick in. So putting more pressure on the halves creates more and more crazier kicks, more and more sort of, unique sort of plays, which I think makes the game more exciting. And I think also the other thing that it has done is that it's introduced not kicking on the 5th tackle, because in fact, this was a low percentage play in the past. You know, you run the ball on the last thinking to score a try. Now you run the ball on the last to try and ensure that you avoid a 7-tackle set. So it's actually brought two elements of the game that kind of was getting a little lost in the era of kick the ball dead to avoid attacking the other team attacking you. Now I think by having the 7-tackle rule, particularly in this deadline scenario, I think it's done. And you know what? I was actually thinking, you know, the NRL should go further on this. We should have 8-tackle sets.
Oh, my God.
But no. for certain things. And I even thought about, what if you had something where you had the automatic reset. So basically, you could have 12 straight tackles, right? But if you don't score, the other team gets 6 points. Kind of like an all-in, what do you think? An all-in sort of maneuver to go, you know what, we're so confident we'll score in the next two sets that we're willing to let the other team have 6 points if we can't score. What about something like that?
Look, teacher, I like it when you think outside the square, but in this case, you're outside of the field altogether. Yeah. This is what
the 7-tackle avoids.
Yeah, well, like let's remember that this was actually brought in. I think we mentioned it before. It was actually Billy Slater It was because opposition coaches didn't want Billy Slater to get the ball and attack, as you mentioned. And so some coaches coach their teams to kick the ball dead to avoid him getting the ball back. Well, that may well be the case. That may well be the reason why they introduced this rule. But what it's done is, like I said, it's fundamentally changed things. So a phrase that you'll hear me often say, Tish, is unintended consequences. So the unintended consequences of a rule change designed to deter teams doing that action to avoid fullbacks getting the ball and running back and all that kind of stuff. What that's done is it's actually made, I believe, which I think I differ from what you're saying, I think it's made the attacking teams more conservative, and it's actually led to more boring play because they're now less likely to kick the ball behind the line, to kick it, grubber kick it, because if it goes dead, wherever they are on the field, even if they do a short grubber kick, because if you don't kick it accurately enough, you could be giving up 7 tackles. I think that is too much of a punishment for potentially a good set of 6 that gets you close to the line, and you just kicked it too far in attempting to, get a grubber in. To me, that's just like saying, you're playing a tennis match, and if you hit the ball a bit too far beyond the baseline, then your opposition player gets 2 serves. That's what it's like. It's actually ridiculous. If you really think about it, it's fundamentally changed the game just to appease a particular tactic that was being used within the confines of the rules, which again, I guess the thing is, if it was agreed that was a problem and we want to avoid that situation, then why not, come up with another alternative rather than just a blanket 7 tackle rule? Why not just sort of say it only applies to kicks, from beyond halfway or something? It only applies to long range kicks. So that way, but then again, like, what if your aim is to kick it long and to try and pin your opposition down, and you just kick it too far? Well, then you've given away, 7 tackles. And that, again, is that too much of a punishment? So I think there's more of a debate to come on this one, but I'm not convinced, and I think the NRL needs to roll back this change, because I think I agree with Gus. It's a stupid rule. It's actually fundamentally changed the fundamental concepts of the game, and it should be changed. Simple as that. So let's move on, shall we, to tackle number 4. Tackle number 4 is about the Tongan Revolution. Tish, do you want to take the lead on this one?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So not really a debate here, but just, maybe our thoughts on this. So Tevita Pangai Jr., who plays for the Brisbane Broncos and is eligible to play for New South Wales. He's a young player, yet to play Origin. And he's actually probably, if you actually watch the Brisbane Broncos play this year, you'll notice him because he's probably been their best player all season. He actually won Man of the Match on last Thursday's game that the Brisbane Broncos played. And, he's come out and said that he does... he's foregone the honour of playing for New South Wales because he's pledged his allegiance to Tonga and has committed to playing for Tonga and does not want to be ruled out for playing for Tonga if he chooses to play for the Blues. So this is another player that we saw it last year before the World Cup, Andrew Fifita, and of course Jason Tamalolo, foregoing their commitments to Australia and New Zealand and deciding to play for Tonga. Now we've got young Tongan players, Tongan eligible players, who are actually even giving up State of Origin just for the chance to play for Tonga. This is why we've called the tackle the Tongan Revolution, because I think it's a great thing that's actually happening in the NRL. Tonga in particular is really seeing this. All these young players, older players, Tongan eligible players who you know, have so much pride and joy for their heritage that they want Tongan Rugby League to be a Class A team. And they're doing it, making huge sacrifices to do it. And I really hope the NRL can get behind them and actually offer more test match opportunities for the Tongan team, particularly if some of the best players in the NRL, because if you think about Tamalolo, Pangai Jr., and Fifita, they're in the top 10 of forwards in the NRL, and they all play for Tonga, and they all want to play for Tonga. So I think more test matches for Tonga versus Australia, Tonga versus New Zealand, Tonga versus England, you know, every year. I think that's what the Tongan Revolution should be about, and it's great to see so many young players and so many players wanting to play for Tonga. What are your thoughts on what's happening with Tongan Rugby League and what the NRL should do about this, Dr. T?
Yeah, look, I think you're right. It is definitely a revolution, and you know, no doubt last year's World Cup will go down as the turning point in sort of the international rugby league you know, environment, where we saw Tonga, you know, almost reaching the final of the World Cup out of nowhere, purely because eligible players chose Tonga as their first choice nation rather than their adopted nation or their nation of birth, Australia or New Zealand. So Tamalolo and Fifita have a lot to do with this, and obviously have led the way, led the revolution. Whatever you think about, and I know there's a lot of people who disagree with, for some reason, a lot of people have been going to town on Fifita for his decision, but don't seem to have the same level of vitriol against Tamalolo. But that's probably because we've got an Australian-centric kind of view here. You know, even though both have essentially done the same thing, they've essentially kind of turn their back on their you know, the land where they were born, I guess, in honor of the land of their ancestry, and as you see, the players who actually were born there, you know, have also decided to stick with their home country. So look, I think it's a great thing that's happening. I don't know if the NRL can do anything about it except acknowledge that what this means is that when they recruit players from the South Pacific nations, that doesn't mean that these players, upon being recruited, are going to eventually be, you know, Australian or Origin representatives. Because I think, you know, now that the eligibility rules have been kind of cleaned up a little bit, and now that you've got this situation that the Tongans are leading, but certainly Fiji is also doing a similar thing, you've got a genuine situation where you know, the big rich NRL clubs will be poaching players, poaching young talent from these South Pacific nations, with really the only transaction being that obviously those players will then play for NRL clubs, get paid by the NRL clubs, and then that should not have an impact on whether those players play representative honours for Australia or New Zealand, whatever the case may be, which is the way it always should have been. So it's kind of a similar situation to any other big sport. You know, you kind of don't, you know, Ben Simmons, everyone's heard about Ben Simmons, Australian, in the NBA, in basketball. You know, doing very well in his first season there, breaking records, all that kind of thing. There's no question that he will represent Australia, the Boomers. But he's a you know, in that sense, he was poached to play over there, you know, developed and all that kind of thing to play in the best competition of that sport in the world. But there's never any kind of expectation that he then represents the country that happens to be where that competition is based. And this is the kind of thing, I think the Tongans have, it's definitely a revolution that needed to happen, and it's a good thing. And I think the NRL should do nothing about it, because the minute it thinks too much about this, It will you know, it detracts it from actually doing things that need to be done, like fixing the fixture cramming issue, which we just spoke about.
And abolishing the seven tackle rule.
The important things. These are the things you should worry about, not this. Let the South Pacific nations grow and develop, and let these players be proud of their heritage and play for their heritage. That's what we want to see. I think the fans want to see it, and the proof is in the pudding, or the proof of the pudding is in the eating, whatever it is. Last year's, you know, absolutely, you know, crazy and amazing fan sort of reaction to the Tongans and the Fijians and the way that they played is proof that this is what the fans really want. This is what gives meaning and value to these international fixtures. And that's what we're all about. That's what got Origin on this, what put State of Origin on the map, is the meaning and the kind of the real authenticity behind the battle. And that's what will bring the fans back to the international game. Tish, I'll let you have the final word.
Yes, look, you're right. Look, I don't want the NRL to do too much. I want these players to play for Tonga. And look, the thing that I do want to see changed is just in terms of scheduling more international games for teams like Tonga. The reason why is because, look, there's a four-year cycle between World Cups, four or five, but I think the next World Cup is in about 4 years. If you think about an Australian player, they've got an opportunity to play three Origin games, at least one Test match against New Zealand, at least another Test match against Great Britain, and probably a third one between either one of these two nations, and instead of Great Britain, I should say England. So they get an opportunity to play six or seven representative games per year, times that out by 4 years. That's about 24 games of high-level international and State of Origin rugby league in preparation for the World Cup. You know, a player like Pangai Jr., who is good enough to play State of Origin, he's only going to get a handful of Pacific Island Test matches per year. So maybe at best, maybe three or four internationals to prepare. You know, that's all the Tongans get. That's all the Fijians get. And if they were put on the same playing field and actually given the same amount of Test matches or international representative opportunities as what the Australian players and New Zealand, and I think New Zealand and England kind of feel the same way. If these nations that are sort of trying to compete against Australia got more opportunities to play against each other, I think it's going to bring a much more competitive rugby league environment towards World Cups. And we could see very shortly Tonga winning the Rugby League World Cup. And I hope that's the end game. I hope that's where it leads to.
All right. That's the final word on that. Let's go to tackle number five. The NRL Hall of Fame 2018 ballot has been released. There is a list of 25 finalists, which, you know, and I think six will be inducted into the Hall of Fame later this year. So we thought we'd go through and rather than naming all of them, we thought we'd, you know, let's see which ones we come up with. Look, before I let you take over the ones that you think are the top six that you would pick, Tish, I'd just like to quickly ask what are the sort of criteria that you're applying here? Because that's one way to sort of, you know, if you want to consistently apply criteria, like say referees rules, you know, one of the things you should do is at least sort of be clear about what are the principles that you're using to base your judgment on. So I thought, you know, if you could just give us a sense of what are the criteria that you think you're using to pick your top six, and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah. Well, I think to be in the Hall of Fame, it is, I mean, you got to think there's 16 clubs at the moment with, you know, 25 players each. So there's hundreds of players playing top flight rugby league. So to be considered in the Hall of Fame, I think you do need to be, you know, probably at least a consistent fixture in, say, the team of the year selections. You know, when people think of you, they think of you as a top player. I think you would have had to have played representative football, either at the State of Origin level or Test match level. And I think on top of that, you probably need to be a bit of a dominant force in these sort of arenas.
Yeah.
And I think that that's kind of the cutoff.
Can I add one more thing to that? Maybe from my perspective, I agree with all that. But one thing I would add is that the influence or dominance or perceived dominance of that player, I think, should have stood the test of time. So I think we should be able to look at that player's achievements, say 20 years later, and go, that person, that guy was dominant in his position, or multiple positions, or whatever the case may be. But he either there was a turning point or something. But something that says it stood the test of time. Not that they were just sort of, you know, big for a year and then nothing really happened. You know, so I think that's, to me, that's one of the criteria I would use as well. You know, and maybe someone that changed the game in the sense that brought, you know, changed the way that position is played. I think that kind of thing is also very valuable.
For the better.
Not like, you know, yeah.
Yeah, like we have to bring in the Smith. Head tackle rule because of this guy, right?
Not like Cam Smith and... All right.
And this is a controversial sort of topic when it comes to other Hall of Fames with other sports, but I also think the off-field also plays a part because you are talking about a Hall of Fame, so players who have actually brought fame to rugby league. So if a player has sort of done something that is kind of, put the game into a negative light and it's got a lasting effect on the game, then I think that also will probably, not count you in sort of thing. Now, I can't think of any player that's actually had any sort of situation that I think is that serious that would actually deny him a chance in the Hall of Fame at the moment. But I think there needs to be a caveat in there to say that. The other thing that I looked at is I actually looked at the 100 players that are already in, and I try to find. This might be a bit of, a bit sort of harsh, but I looked for the Gate Hall of Famer, as I called it, which is that guy that sort of scraped into the Hall of Fame and then tried to compare some of these players to that Gate player and to think, okay, well, this guy got in. Would that mean that, you know, should this player...
Right, yep.
Okay. And look, I actually really loved him as a player. So can I reveal to you who I thought the Gate out of the top 100 is?
Before you do that, I think in my world, I would call that test the nightclub bouncer test.
Okay.
Which is right. Basically, oi, let me in. You let that dude in.
Yeah.
How'd you let him in? Yeah, okay, go for it.
Okay, so in the top 100, and look, I could be wrong, I don't know. And look, as I said, he's a great player, and I think he is a Hall of Famer. But I think the line is Andrew Enninghausen.
Oh, no, you can't say that.
Well,
no way.
Here's the thing about Andrew Enninghausen. He's a great player, right? He played for Australia, played for, played for Cronulla, played for, you know, State of Origin, all that sort of stuff. Man of the match performances, all that great stuff. But not a premiership winner. And on the ballot for who's not in is Steve Renoff. And then if I compare Steve Renoff to Andrew Enninghausen, I'd say that Steve Renoff is probably worthy of a Hall of Fame if Andrew Enninghausen is.
Wait, but isn't he nominated this time around?
He's nominated this time around. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. So, like.
So, but hang on. So that doesn't mean that the players that are there now are any less than the players that are in.
No, I'm not saying they're less in, but I'm just sort of saying, okay, Steve Renoff probably should go in because there are players that are in the current 100, which he is very comparable to and arguably better than.
Yeah, in the same position. Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I would agree with that.
So that's one from the list. And that would also put, in my mind, Stacey Jones and Ricky Stewart in of the Alan Langer factor, because I think Alan Langer is already in there, and I kind of think that Stacey Jones, from a New Zealand point of view, had the same impact that as an Alan Langer did, and I think that Ricky Stewart was, you know, sometimes considered ahead of Alan Langer, and they were career rivals when it came to that position. Exactly. So,
all right,
so that's what, yeah.
So I just want to, I want to hear your list. And I think what we should do is maybe we should come up with an agreed list and see what happens at the, like, rather than do a tipping thing. Let's see if we can agree to a list of six right now and then see what ends up happening. So I want to hear your list. I'm going to write it down and then I'll go through and see if I agree or disagree. What do you say? Here we go.
All right. Not a problem. So I've just named a few there. So Steve Renoff.
Steve Renoff. Yep.
Yep. Okay. Ricky Stewart.
Yep.
Stacey Jones.
Yep.
Okay. So that's the thing. Like, there's a lot of players that are on here that I haven't seen play.
Yeah.
I'm going to put Pedro Sinner-Vasiva in there. Just as an ambassador and so forth. So that's four. See, now I'm stretching here because they all sort of seem very, very close. There's a few people that I don't want to put in there. Oh, Gordon Tallis. I think Gordon Tallis is a bit of a shoe-in, actually. And Danny Badiris. Is that six?
Yep. And I can tell you've got a very much a late 90s, you know, like early 2000s bias, because I agree with some of those and completely disagree with others. So let's have a look at some of these. So I agree, maybe some of these show you're showing your age or your youth a little bit there, Tish, because I've got to disagree with some of them. So let me just go through if I may. The ones that I definitely agree with, 100%, no question, Steve Renoff and Ricky Stewart. Steve Renoff was an absolute superstar in the centers there. He had so many memorable moments, you know, not to mention the, you know, and in crucial games, the famous, you know, grand final length of the field try, I think it was 92, when they flogged the Dragons. That will be, that's one of the best tries that you'll see in a grand final. And he just dominated that position. He was magical to see, so I think he definitely needs to be in there. Ricky Stewart, I agree. I think as much as our view of him might be tainted as in terms of his coaching escapades, I think as a player, I actually preferred him over Alan Langer. I remember, you know, watching the tussle between – I mean, it was – the Stewart and Langer tussle was, you know, equivalent of the equivalent to the Sterling and Mortimer clashes in the late 80s. It was virtually the same thing, but a decade later. The ideal sort of situation as an Australian team would be to have both of those players in your team, but often one had to miss out. So Ricky Stewart should definitely be there. He was part of the green machine when they dominated the ARL and NRL, or New South Wales Rugby League at the time. Those two are definites, I would say. But I just want to take you through some other ones that potentially I disagree. Let me have a think about Stacey Jones, because I'm not sure whether he's achieved, like, in terms of – there's something to be said about putting a player in there because they happen to be part of a winning team, as opposed to they individually contributed something that led to other changes. So I look at for example – Gordon Tallis as not necessarily someone who, he certainly played a lot of tests and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. He did win the Clive Churchill medal in a grand final. And so that sort of puts you up there because you did sort of perform at the highest level. Let me just have a look at some of the other players that are there. So Stacey Jones. So if I'm looking at Stacey Jones as an example, would it be easier if I give you an alternative to some of the players? So
okay, go for
Petro
it.
Petro Sivanasiva and Gordon Tallis were forwards. As far as forwards go, I would say that, that someone who had a bigger impact and a more lasting impact at the same kind of level as those two would be Paul Harrigan. He actually led his team to their first ever premiership win. You know, and he captained them, you know, for a few years. And it happened to be, you know, during the period where they obviously won the 97 premiership as well. So there's that. He also, you know, had similar number of State of Origin appearances as both Sivan Asiva and Gordon Tallis. But I think he was a very, very consistent sort of feature in the Australian sides of, you know, of the mid to late 90s as well. So I think I would put him up there, probably the equal of Sivan Asiva and definitely higher than Gordon Tallis in that respect. So anyway, that's just one opinion. So I would put that up there. I would also look at Stacey Jones. So look, he was look, maybe I can't really argue with Stacey Jones. I mean, he did quite well through a pretty good season, good sort of career. Instead of Gordon Tallis, I would actually suggest one other player as a forward who actually, in my view, changed the game and has had a longer lasting impact and actually broke some records. And that would be Steve Menzies. He burst onto the scene as a player. People didn't know what to make of him. You know, here he was, a forward, a second rower, and mainly a second rower, who actually was so tall and lanky. What was his name? Gene Miles from the centres. Like, he was that kind of a player, and he played like a centre, very fast player, elusive. He changed the game. He actually, in terms of legacy, I think what was it, one of his records? I think he had a record that he. So apart from, you know, being a constant selection in the Australian lineup and all that kind of thing, he actually what did he do? He became the first forward in 50 years to be the premiership's leading try scorer. So he was a try scoring forward. So I'm going to suggest to you that instead of Gordon Tallis, we put in Steve Menzies, because I think Menzies broke the mold for a try-scoring forward. And let's not forget the way Manly decimated the Melbourne Storm in, when was it, 2007, 2009, 8, something like that.
That's Steve Menzies coming back, right?
That's right. And so he is an absolute legend of the game, in my view. Look, Gordon Tallis is. That's not to say Gordon Tallis is not, shouldn't be talked about in those circles. But when I look at the list and of comparable kind of positions, I sort of look at Menzies and say he should definitely be up there because he actually changed the game. So I'm going to suggest a swap. I'm going to suggest Menzies for Gordon Tallis and Danny Badiris. Well, I'm not sure. That he had enough of a an impact on the game. I mean, he was a good player, definitely. But I would suggest someone else who people sometimes forget. Again, people who are in the media, like for example, Paul Harrigan. I think his legacy is tainted somewhat by his.
I'm a celebrity. Get me out of here.
By his shenanigans on the Footy Show before that.
There you go. So this is the off-field stuff I was talking about. You know, he's the Pete Rose of the Hall of
Fame. No, but he's not. But that should not taint at all his legacy, though. I look at someone like, you know, someone out of the backs who are remaining there. I would put Greg Alexander as someone that needs to be up there. He was the reason why Penrith won their first premiership. And I think that as, you know, he was very consistent. He played in two positions. He actually played in at fullback as well. In fact, he was quite a versatile player, played in the backs a lot. But he broke so many records, like highest try scorer at the time for the Penrith club. He basically turned the Penrith club from a joke to a winning team. And he won them, he captained them to their first ever premiership in 1991, and he, obviously he won you know, the Dally M medal. He won Best Player of the Year, several, you know, or Halfback of the Year at one time as well. In what is really a crucial position as well. So I would say that he should be a contender there. I would swap him out for Danny Badiris because I think the impact is longer lasting in terms of what he did at the Penrith Panthers. And again, that's the people sort of tend to forget. Oh, they think of him as a commentator now on Fox Sports, but you know, before that, he was so talented. I mean, he was a Rookie of the Year, and he went on to be not just Rookie of the Year, but ended up being the game's best player, you know, a few times after that. So at a time when you've had, you know, players like Stirling Mortimer, he ended up winning the Dally M medal during that period in the mid 80s. So I think that's no mean feat. And he's often forgotten because, you know, there are so many good halfbacks out there. But I think he did enough to sort of show that he, in terms of what he did for Penrith, put them on the map. More so than anyone else, I think. And even though Royce Simmons was there, I think individually in terms of talent, Greg Alexander had it all over some of the players of that era. So, and then people still talk about how talented he was. So I would put him up there. But there is one more player that I, or a couple that I want to put up there.
Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we have a bit of a recess on this for this week? And let's come back next week after giving like an extra week. Because look, even myself are looking at players like, say, Cliff Lyons and Bobby Lidner, and there's some actually really great players.
Michael O'Connor.
I haven't even talked about yet. O'Connor as well. And,
exactly.
All right. You know, and I think, because like it is a very hard thing to do. And, you know, you've got to think about positions and players and impact. And so why don't we give ourselves an extra week and let's come up with our six. You know, my six, your six, and then the six.
Right.
And let's see how close we get to what the NRL has.
Super, let's do that. All right, and let's move on to tackle number six. So the NRL round 9 matches. So here we go. The tipping, well, we got 4 out of 8. That pushes you to 34 and me to 29. So I still have to catch up 5 behind you. So here we go, the tips for this week. Broncos versus Bulldogs. I'm tipping the Broncos.
Yes, the Broncos for mine. Pretty easy win for them, I think.
Rabbitohs and Knights. Rabbitohs to bounce back.
Oh, the Knights are in form. They're moving up the ladder. I think it's a different season for them this year. I'm tipping the Knights in this one.
Panthers and Cowboys. And I think the Panthers will continue to their winning ways.
Yeah, the Cowboys, not really talked about, but having a very ordinary season. The Panthers riding high, and I think more victory, despite the 7-tackle rule.
And another team that's sort of flown under the radar, the Raiders, against the Titans, and I'm picking the Raiders.
Look, I'm going to be with you on this one. I'm tipping the Raiders. I think the Titans are sort of on again, off again. Last week they were on, but I think this week they'll be off.
And here are two teams at the top that are desperate to push ahead. Warriors versus Tigers after losses this weekend. I'm tipping the Warriors.
Look, I can't go past the Tigers on this one. They need to win, and we've got some players coming back from injury, which is fantastic.
The Sharks versus the Eels. I'm obviously tipping the Eels.
In past year's traditional wooden spoon contest. Or is that, but it's like, but look, the Sharks haven't really impressed and the Eels are on a roll. So I'm going to tip the Eels in an upset.
All right. The Dragons and the Storm. This is a not quite top of the table clash, but close enough to it. This is the game that tells us how much of a contender the Storm are. And I don't think they will be because I think the Dragons will win.
Oh, look, the Dragons, I don't think they're going to have the choking that they normally do. In saying that, I think the Melbourne are coming good, so I'm going to tip the Storm.
And the Roosters and the Seagulls, Manly, are in trouble. The Roosters desperate for a win, and I think that will be enough to turn them around, so the Roosters will win that one.
Yeah, look, can we call this the Fatty Vaughton Cup?
Okay.
But I think the Roosters, they lost last week, so they should win this week. Having an up and down season, they should win it. Meanwhile, Manly, you know, the drama is bigger than the club at the moment, and I think they have to sort out that yard. I mean, there's so many different things happening. I think Hastings might be back for this game and crazy stuff. But yeah, look, I think the Roosters for mine.
Yeah, and what they call in the Sydney Beaches Cup, of course, the Bondi versus Manly. It should be a good one, actually. Look, that's it for the tips. And don't forget, everyone, to check us out on iTunes, on Facebook as well. Please like our page and share our podcast to everyone that you know. Don't forget to download all of our podcasts and leave a comment if you can on iTunes as well. So, Tish, over to you to wrap this up.
Well, thank you, Dr. T. And look, thank you all for listening to this edition of the Rugby League Republic. I hope you had as much fun listening to us as we've had in bringing it to you. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have on this week's edition of the Rugby League Republic. Please join us next time on the Rugby League Republic. Bye for now.